Welcome to the Jeremiah Patterson Show, and thank you for joining me this Tuesday. His name was Eugene Debs, and in 1920, as a presidential candidate, Eugene Debs was indicted, convicted, and locked up at a federal penitentiary in Atlanta, Georgia. It was after a stringent and compelling investigation that he was indicted and booked at an Atlanta jail on the charges that was alleged in the indictment. His mugshot was also taken. He was outspoken and defiant, but he just could not evade the law. This is a real story. This was during World War II at the time, and he was speaking at a rally of about several hundred people, and he said something that at the time could get you in trouble with the government. Eugene Debs criticized the war. And at the time, you could not do that because of something called the Sedition Act of 1918. And so this law basically said you cannot speak out against the war whatsoever. You cannot disagree. Everyone has to be in consensus, at least publicly. And Eugene Debs did not adhere to that law. He was immediately arrested and he was sent to jail and his mugshot was taken. I kid you not. Google this. This is the real story. Google Eugene Debs mugshot. You might see a side-by-side of another person that you may know. But yeah, this is real. And after the investigation concluded, an indictment was handed down and Mr. Debs arrived at the Atlanta jail to have his mugshot taken and to be booked on sedition charges. His campaign was very, very quick to capitalize off of what had just happened. Buttons with his prison number 9653 were being passed around along with photos of his mugshot. The federal prosecutor that handed down this indictment to Eugene Debs, essentially indicting him, arresting him for what he said here at this rally, violating federal law. The federal prosecutor, Edwin Wirtz, said, quote, "No man, even though four times the candidate of his party for the highest office in the land can violate the basic law of the land," end quote. He was found guilty by the grand jury and he was sentenced to three simultaneous 10-year prison sentences and lost his right to vote. He did appeal and ran for president again in 1920 from prison and lost, but he did garner 1 million votes. And whatever you may think of this story, the parallel there it's there. It's very prescient. A presidential candidate who was under investigation while running for president was indicted, arrested, and then booked on the charge that he was accused and convicted of. That recent parallel in our nation's history is where we can look back to today for some type of historical resonance, some type of historical rhyme. This has happened before in an electoral sense to a presidential candidate, but never before a former president. And that's where we enter new terrain as a country. That's what makes this a more transcendent and imperative moment for us as a nation, for us as a republic. Last week at an Atlanta jail, Donald Trump turned himself in and was booked on 13 felony counts alleged in this superseding indictment, 41-count indictment charging him and 19 other co-defendants. And his mugshot was taken and he was processed. Now, he did not actually spend the night in jail, but this is a monumental moment for our country, especially in history. Never before in the history of this country has a current or former president been indicted for anything. Neither was a mugshot ever taken of a former president. A presidential candidate, yes, but not a president. There have been impeachments, investigations, inquiries against presidents, but never an indictment, especially not at the federal level. And that is until now. And because we are living in such unprecedented times, things are moving fast. Let me just begin with the preface here. There have been multiple indictments. But we are going to start tonight with the one out of Georgia. We know that the district attorney in this case is Fani Willis. She has been investigating these actions for 2 years. Now, here we are with this 41-count indictment. It is 97 pages. I'm not going to lie. I did not read them all. Although I tried. I mean, but just based off not fully reading this indictment, and just based off what I read, you can already kind of tell that this is strong and extremely serious when it comes to the development in the criminal proceedings against the former president. Trump is charged along with 19 other co-defendants in this case. All 19 of them turned themselves in, took their mugshots, and were booked on the charges alleged in the superseding indictment. I will tell you, when the court paper leaked consisting of the charges in this indictment, everyone sort of scrambled. We were all just kind of sitting on the edge of our seats waiting for the full indictment to be released. But we got it. And this is how it starts. Quote, Defendant Donald John Trump lost the United States presidential election held on November 3rd, 2020. One of the states he lost was Georgia. Trump and other defendants charged in this indictment refused to accept that Trump lost, and they knowingly and willfully joined a conspiracy to unlawfully change the outcome of the election in favor of Trump. That conspiracy contained a common plan and purpose to commit two or more acts of racketeering activity in Fulton County, Georgia, elsewhere in the state of Georgia, and in other states. At all times relevant to this case, to the count of this indictment, the defendants, as well as others not named as defendants, unlawfully conspired, endeavored to conduct and participate in a criminal enterprise in Fulton County, Georgia, and elsewhere. It then goes on to list like a long list of the defendants, and other known and unknown to the grand jury, quote, constituted a criminal organization whose members and associates engaged in various related criminal activities, including but not limited to false statements and writings, impersonating a public officer, filing false documents, influencing witnesses, computer theft, computer trespass, computer invasion of privacy, computer to defraud the state, acts involving theft and perjury, end quote. I know, that was a lot. But let's just start with the basics here, because there's already so much in just that brief synopsis of what this indictment is going to be about. So right off the bat, we get the crime. Trump, with the help of others, tried to overturn the election in Georgia, in the state of Georgia. Yes, this was orchestrated at the federal level by Trump sitting in the White House and doing all this, but he did send his guys down to Georgia. You don't have to step into the state of Georgia in order to be charged in this indictment. You know, I mean, come on, guys. Then we get more of the charges. But what is essentially clearer in this part of this indictment is that they operated as a criminal enterprise. And Fannie Willis makes that specific point here because of racketeering. Racketeering is a charge that's being used in this indictment. And racketeering is a charge that they use to go after mobsters. They use racketeering to go after people like, you know, the people in The Godfather. And the reason that this case is so serious and hard-hitting is because that statute usually sticks and wins in court. Under Georgia law, racketeering usually involves a scheme, and that scheme does not need to be successful in order for the RICO statute to stick. And so RICO under Georgia law states that an enterprise can just be one person or a group of associated individuals with a common goal, in this case, a group of individuals conspiring to steal the election, conspiring to falsify the election, conspiring to overturn the results of a lawfully legal, completed, accurate election. And according to the Associated Press, racketeering activity means to commit or to solicit or coerce or intimidate someone else to commit one or more, or essentially 36 state crimes listed in the law. And in order for prosecutors to get and secure a conviction, they just have to prove that a person engaged in committing at least two or more related criminal acts as they're participating in the enterprise. The bare minimum is two. And that's where she got all of them, because what we have is charged here. I mean, false statements and writings can be attributed back to the unofficial Georgia slate of electors for Trump, which was fake because he did not win that state. That's also under the filing false documents. Intimidating other officials involved harassing and lying to Ruby Freeman and her daughter, Shay Moss, who were election workers. There was a video of them moving ballots from one place to another, and Trump, along with others, vociferously attacked that as a criminal activity to support their stolen election conspiracy. This video was repeatedly televised at rallies that Trump held shortly after the election. It's like, oh yeah, there was a fraud right there. You see, they're moving the ballots. This family was incessantly harassed. Trump supporters showed up to their home, and a person associated with the Trump campaign showed up to Mrs. Freeman's house and told her that this would all go away if she just turned herself in. It was a Kanye West public consultant who was associated with the Trump campaign. And, you know, it was a black person. It was a black lady. She showed up. She was part of this organization, essentially Blacks for Trump. And, you know, she basically said, hey, Miss Freeman, we can protect you. Just say you did it. Miss Freeman did not feel comfortable talking to her specifically at the door or for her to come inside her home, so she was escorted to a police station where they spoke. But the lady essentially said to her, "Hey, just say you did it. We can protect you. This will all go away. The threats against you will go away." But that is not what happened. The threats that ended up getting so bad that the FBI told her to leave her home. These were two black election officials in Fulton County. And Shay Moss and her mother, Miss Freeman, they testified to the January 6th committee last year in a televised hearing. And in terms of election interference, in terms of like asking another individual to help commit a crime in the state of Georgia, that would be the phone call between Trump and the Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger. Quote, "I just want you to find 11,780 votes. That's all I need, Brad. Come on. That's not too much to ask for, right?" Remember that phone call? That was in Georgia, January 2021. That's the president on video trying to get the Secretary of State of Georgia to go along with this election scheme and give Trump the allotted votes he needs to secure the state of Georgia, therefore increasing his lead over Biden. So this was a plot to take the White House for a second term, regardless of losing, regardless of knowing that you lost and still pushing this in the process. For additional criminal conduct in the state of Georgia, the indictment states that Georgia legislators received false statements with the purpose of persuading them to reject lawful electoral votes. Quote, "Members of the enterprise corruptly solicited Georgia legislators instead to unlawfully appoint their own presidential electors for the purpose of casting electoral votes for Donald Trump." End quote. So we have false statements to high-ranking officials in the state, the creation and distribution of false Electoral College documents, harassing and intimidating election officials, including Miss Ruby Freeman and also her daughter, Shay Moss, soliciting officials at the highest levels from DOJ to assist in this scheme. Jeffrey Clark, namely so, also charged in this indictment. There are 161 criminal acts in this indictment with 41 counts. This indictment out of Fulton County also lists the other states in which this enterprise operated, including Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Washington, D.C. Now, I should mention that as it pertains to this matter, there are multiple separate and open investigations in other states related to the election interference and the fake electors plot. There was also an investigation related to that matter at the federal level as well, where an indictment was just recently handed down. The judge in that case yesterday set the trial date for May of 2024, as this coincides with the other criminal trials that Trump has all happening essentially simultaneously, either before or after the 2024 presidential election, as those get scheduled in tandem. Now, this federal indictment that is from the Jack Smith investigation at DOJ, that kept the nation on edge for so long. But when it was released, what we get here is that this specific indictment is not from the states, right? This is historic because it is handed down from the feds. For the past few months, there has been a lot of talk about different jurisdictions finishing their findings and coming to the conclusion of their investigation on the indictments being released. But what we have here is from Georgia. We got that indictment, 41 count indictment. Trump and 19 other defendants charged. We get other indictments as well, but this federal indictment is the most recent one before Georgia. And it's from the District of Columbia. This is the feds. And this is the result of a federal grand jury investigation about the interference in the 2020 presidential election regarding overturning the results, which led to the insurrection on the Capitol on January 6th. The indictment begins, quote, "The defendant Donald J. Trump was the 45th president of the United States and a candidate for re-election in 2020. The defendant lost the 2020 presidential election. Despite having lost, the defendant was determined to remain in power. So for more than 2 months following Election Day, on November 3rd, 2020, the defendant spread lies that there had been outcome determinative fraud in the election and that he had actually won. These claims were false. And the defendant knew that they were false, but the defendant repeatedly and widely disseminated them anyway. to make his unknowingly false claims appear legitimate, create an intense national atmosphere of mistrust and anger, and erode public faith in the administration of the election. The defendant had a right, like every American, to speak publicly about the election and even to claim falsely that there had been outcome determinative fraud during the election and that he had actually won. He was also entitled to formally challenge the results of the election through lawful and appropriate means, such as seeking recounts or audits of the popular vote in states or filing lawsuits challenging ballots and procedures. Indeed, in many cases, the defendant did pursue these methods of contesting the election results. His efforts to change the outcome in any state through recounts, audits, or legal challenges were uniformly unsuccessful. Shortly after Election Day, the defendant also pursued unlawful means of discounting legitimate votes and subvert the election results. In so doing, the defendant perpetrated three criminal conspiracies. One, a conspiracy to defraud the United States by using dishonesty, fraud, and deceit to impair, obstruct, and defeat the lawful federal government function by which the results of the presidential election are collected, counted, and certified by the federal government. Two, a conspiracy to corruptly obstruct and impede the January 6th congressional proceeding. Three, a conspiracy against the right to vote and to have one's vote counted in the violation of 18 section code. Each of these conspiracies, which build on the widespread mistrust the defendant was creating through pervasive and destabilizing lies about election fraud, targeted a bedrock function of the United States federal government, the nation's process of collecting, counting, and certifying the results of the presidential election. End quote. So that's how the indictment begins, laying the facts out completely straightforward, right? I mean, it's clear and concise for the public to see. And the language does not really consist of excessive legal jargon. It's very coherent and easy on the eyes for you to read. I mean, if you're not a lawyer or you did not pay attention to anything in 2020, which is hard to believe of, by the way, this indictment just lays the facts out in a way that is super easy to understand. We know from this indictment that per the results of this grand jury federal investigation, that Trump is charged with one count of conspiracy to defraud the United States in violation of U.S. Code Section 18. In addition to this, he is charged with two counts of obstructing the vote certification that took place on the Capitol on January 6th, and one count of conspiracy to violate civil rights, impeding on everyone's right to vote. To essentially disregard those votes and wishes of the American people by seeking to overturn the results and put them in his favor. And so this federal indictment acknowledges that Trump was well within his legal and constitutional rights to lie about the election, being stolen, to challenge it. And it wasn't until he actually started doing something about it that he crossed over into illegal waters. When he interfered in these electoral affairs by calling up state officials and blatantly asking them to increase his percentage, and he intermingled in state and county affairs, that's when he crossed the line and violated the law. Those actions, as this indictment says, were illegal, quote, unlawful means of discounting legitimate votes and subverting the election results. End quote. And so now we begin to get here into the nitty and gritty of this indictment, the very key parts. There are six co-conspirators listed. Co-conspirator one is described as a lawyer who was willing to lie about the election and pursue litigation that campaign lawyers would not. That is believed to be Rudy Giuliani. Co-conspirator two is John Eastman, who is essentially was in charge of devising a plan to coerce the vice president into believing that he somehow had a constitutional power to overturn the federal presidential election. That's co-conspirator two. Sidney Powell is believed to be co-conspirator three because of, you know, her completely out of line and completely asinine commentary. And co-conspirator four is believed and described to be a high-ranking official from the U.S. Justice Department who was involved in this scheme as well. That is not ambiguous because that is believed to be Jeffrey Clark, who was almost became the acting attorney general of the United States. He essentially was tasked with, you know, calling up officials in Georgia and essentially trying to coerce other officials to, hey guys, we should investigate this election. This election is kind of sketchy here. We should perhaps look into this. That's Jeffrey Clark. Except he did not become attorney general because, you know, there was a whole massacre scare resignation style thing at the Justice Department, a repeat of the Saturday Night Massacre back in Watergate when Nixon tried to fire the Attorney General and then various other officials resigned. Basically, what happened in this case is officials at the Justice Department said that if Jeffrey Clark became Attorney General, they would all resign en masse. It would be a constitutional crisis at DOJ. So they did not put Jeffrey Clark as the Attorney General. Yet, he's still engaged in these actions. That's not going away. He's still engaged in these actions. Kenneth Cheeseborough is believed to be co-conspirator number 5, with efforts to implement and plan essentially to submit fraudulent states of electors to obstruct the certification proceeding, and co-conspirator 6 is believed to be Boris Epstein, a political consultant who assisted Cheeseborough in this scheme. And you know, I really wish we could go over all these again and like fully subsidize this information. I know I've been talking for 20 minutes, but this is just like a representation of how vast the criminal proceedings against the former president are. And the same co-conspirators that are listed in this federal indictment, the results of this federal grand jury investigation, the same conspirators that are listed in this indictment make up the same list, except longer, who were just indicted in Georgia. Kenneth Cheeseborough, as I say there, Kenneth Cheeseborough is actually an interesting character in this development because he, along with Sidney Powell, are trying to have a speedy trial. It was just on Thursday last week that a judge said, hey, well, you want to do a speedy trial? A judge has set Kenneth Cheeseborough's trial in this Georgia case for October 23rd. That is just one defendant along with the others that are charged in this case here. Sidney Powell has also requested a speedy trial. She is an attorney as well, but her trial date has not been set yet. Mark Meadows, the White House chief of staff, who actually did step foot in Georgia for this whole thing, which was, forgive me, ludicrous and incredibly belligerent when it comes to laws and constitutional means and respect for the Constitution and respect for your oath of office. He wants to move this whole Georgia trial out of state. Let's move this to the federal level so I have a better chance to essentially not be convicted, I guess. Argue that this was somehow within his purview of the chief of staff. This was somehow in his purview of his official duties as the federal, essentially, chief in the White House. So this whole thing is a developing case. It's a developing umbrella here. The first indictment against Trump was in New York. That was in Manhattan, where he was charged with 34 felonies, which included falsifying business records, hush money payments to two porn stars, intent to commit or conceal another crime, including state and federal election laws as well, in violation of those. That was indictment one. Indictment two came out of Florida with 40 counts. Indictment 3 is the federal election interference case, and indictment 4 is out of Georgia. Now, when it comes to this Florida indictment, that's the classified documents case where Trump is accused of mishandling classified information and taking it home, right? You're not supposed to do that, yet he did it anyways. And in this Florida indictment case, it basically accuses the former president, you know, what's alleged in this indictment, of taking documents home. Quote, at 12 o'clock p.m. on January 20th, 2021, so this is Inauguration Day, Trump ceased to be president. As he departed the White House, Trump caused scores of boxes, many of which contained classified information, to be transported to the Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach, Florida, where he maintained his residence. Trump was not authorized to possess or retain those classified documents. The Mar-a-Lago Club was an active social club, which between January 2021 and August 2022 hosted events for tens of thousands of members and guests. After Trump's presidency, the Mar-a-Lago Club was not an authorized location for storage, possession, review, display, or discussion of classified documents. Nevertheless, Trump stored his boxes containing classified information in various locations at the Mar-a-Lago Club, including in a ballroom, a bathroom, a shower, an office space, his bedroom, and a storage room. End quote. So this was just in the bathroom? This was just like, I guess, some nighttime reading in his bedroom. The indictment goes on to say that in most of these rooms where these classified documents were, where this classified material was, various of these doors were literally quite open to the public, and tens of thousands of events were hosted at Mar-a-Lago, including events where foreign nationals attended. But these classified documents were, hey, willy-nilly out in the open for all to see. Or at least for all to essentially investigate. Hey, what are those boxes back there? It's not like this was in some concealed room where Trump said, lock it up. No, these indictments were, for the most part, out in the open. This indictment out of Florida also goes on to essentially talk about how the former president tried to obstruct this investigation by not handing documents to the FBI, by essentially telling his staffers to flush them down the toilet, by also telling his staffers to essentially hide the indictments from his lawyers so his lawyers could not go back and tell the FBI, hey guys, look what we have here. We have more of the documents to turn in that the National Archives was looking for. We also get in this indictment the overt action by Trump, essentially spelling it straight out loud that he knew these documents were classified, yet he still shared them with officials. I mean, completely astonishing. This is from page nine of the indictment. Quote, Trump stated, in my administration, I'm going to enforce all laws concerning the protection of classified information. No one will be above the law. So he said that in his administration. The indictment then goes on to say here on page 11, quote, this is Trump employee number two. We can definitely make it work if we move his papers into the lake room, Trump employee number one. There is still little room in the shower where his other stuff is. Is it only his papers he cares about? There's some other stuff in there that are not papers. Could that go into storage? Or does he want everything in there on property? Trump employee number two. Yes, anything that's not the beautiful mine paper boxes can definitely go to storage. Want to take a look at the space and start moving tomorrow in the morning? So these are just two employees essentially going back and forth, conversing on what they should do with the documents here. And out of the 60-page indictment, I swear, page number 15 just makes you want to freaking, like, jump. It's so hair-curdling and also terrifying at the same time. Quote, Trump. Well, with senior military official, let me see that. I'll show you an example. He said that I wanted to attack country A. Isn't it amazing? I have a big pile of papers. This just came up. Look, this was him. They presented me this off the record, but they presented me with this. This was him. This was the Department of Defense and him. End quote. Trump is showing an official. And Trump also says this, quote, except it's highly confidential. So, this is the former president of the United States, Donald John Trump. He's talking to this official. He's talking to this staffer about this military operation, right, that he's supposed to carry out as president. Classified documents with the Department of Defense. He's showing this to a staffer at the White House. He even tells the staffer, hey, don't get too close because this is classified. He even says it's highly confidential. I mean, just overt. Actions were known. It's not like this was something that was not known to Trump. He knew that this was highly confidential. He even knew that he shouldn't be sharing it with that official because, hey, don't get too close. This is classified. So the president acknowledged that. Four indictments handed down, including one at the federal level. 91 felonies for the former president altogether. It is astonishing what has happened. It is astonishing in these indictments what we have just here. These are ongoing investigations, most of them already ready to move to trial, as other investigations continue in other states. But it is also a stark moment for us as a country to really take this in and realize where we are and where we are going. Because this is not a presidential candidate speaking out and violating a wartime act, speaking out against the war. This is not a presidential candidate unlawfully doing something or doing something that he didn't know he shouldn't be doing. This is a former president of the United States doing something that he knows he should not be doing, yet he is doing it anyway. And that is new terrain for us as a country, because what we are essentially gearing to is something that we've never really faced before as a nation, as a country, as a society. What we are facing here is an unprecedented attack on the U.S. government as a whole, an unprecedented attack on our institutions as a government, as a functioning society in the United States, as a constitutional republic, as a law-abiding society. We are facing a turnover and a difference, a legitimate, diametrically extreme difference that we've never really faced before as a nation. There are no legitimate historical comparisons that we can, you know, have a parallel to or analogize. This is an isolated incident. This is the former president of the United States committing crimes, knowing that he's committing these crimes, still committing the crimes, and continuing to do so. Accountability is on the way as most of these investigations are coming to a close and the trial dates are set. The question is for us as a nation, how are we going to take this in? How are we going to cohesively as a country come together and acknowledge this? How are we going to react to that information at the ballot box in 2024? What are we going to do as a society to come together and decide on if we want that type of person contemplating and doing those type of actions? Do we want that type of person with the nuclear launch codes again? Do we want that type of person in office again as president? These are the actions we really do have to consider and to talk about as these trials begin, as these trials start to come underway. Whew. I did not intend to talk for 32 minutes. But I talked for 32 minutes. I was going to go to commercial break, but I'm going to end it here because I just wanted to explain to everyone the indictments and everything that's in here. But thank you for joining me on this episode of the Jeremiah Patterson Show. I really, really appreciate it. A lot definitely happening. Keep your eyes open, heads up, because these are active investigations for the most part. And also what we are now starting to see, the announcing dates of the trials that are set in these investigations. Thank you for being with us on this episode of the Jeremiah Patterson Show. Have a great day. Remember to stay positive and inspired. If anyone among you is equally flabbergasted or just confused or does not have time to read this indictment, send this episode to them. It'll be very helpful in terms of information and also saving you from 97 pages of anguish, which in some cases repeats itself a lot. So, no excessive legal jargon. Just listen to this episode. You'll be fine. I swear, everything is here. All right, have a good one. Thank you for listening. I will see you again soon because we're doing lots of work here on the Jeremiah Patterson Show in terms of production. Lots of specials planned and episodes coming up as well. All right, have a good one. I've never talked for 33 minutes before. This is insane. Have a great day. Remember to stay positive and inspired, and take care.